going to try and do today is to show Nemo here, but apart from that, here we go. And I'm just going to put my timer, otherwise I'm not going to know when to stop. So we have decided the way we want to talk about business models is in terms of other concepts. So I'm going to try and introduce those to you today. So we talk a lot about digital innovation. And digital innovation is easy to find. Here's an example of one. It's Facebook. It's the third largest country in the world, next after China and India. Every time the X Factor is on, there's 2 million status updates in the UK, just to give you an idea, right? So one of the first things we need to get sorted is, what is this based on? Well, the underlying underlying disruptive factor in all of this is what you call digitizing, or the socio-technical process of digitalization. So digitizing is basically to transform something that previously was analog to become digital. And what happens, as I've tried to illustrate on this slide, is let's imagine you have a piece of music, and if you have in the analog world, you might have, those of you who are old enough, remember there's something called vinyl. I have 1,000 of them. I'm about to move in storage, so I will know that I have 1,000 very soon. They are sort of linked. The music was linked to a certain storage format. It was linked to a certain processing technology. When you have one of these, you need one of these as well. And then to a certain distribution system. So the global distribution system of record distributors and wholesalers and publishing houses and all stuff. And what happens is, when you digitize this, then the socio-technical arrangements around that whole system becomes completely different. You can still have vinyl. Now, actually, there's an increase in vinyl. 2 years ago, they sold 300,000 vinyl records globally. Now, in the US, now this year is projected to be 3.6 million. So the kids are going back to vinyl again. Brilliant. I have an investment. So the point is that there's a loose coupling between these, that there's no longer a strong coupling between the storage format, processing technology, and distribution system. And indeed, you can have a multiplicity within each, that the processing of this particular object, from being linked to a particular, like a turntable, now it can be on your watch, on your turntable, or on your iPad. And in the same way, of course, as the most well illustrated by Napster, there is suddenly a disruptive factor that new entrants can enter, and people vote with their feet and have free music, and it was fantastic as long as it lasted. So what we can see now, of course, this is not about the music business, but what we can see that the music business, they have pulled a big trick on us all. That they have pulled a trick when the CD came in, that they managed to grow the market significantly, or at least grow the value significantly, and now digital is coming to erode it very, very slowly. So what you tend to see is, when digitalization appears, it starts by paving the way that was already there and making it more smooth. So from vinyl to CDs, it was made much smoother. But at some point, things start happening, and what starts happening is the erosion of control. And that's what we are particularly interested in. So this idea of the unfreezing and freezing of control. So this is so there are many ways you can look at business models and how to make money, but we tend to think that it's incredibly important to start by looking at control, because this is one of the big changes. So here, if you take this distinction between content, application, and infrastructure, what has happened is that digitalization has been shaking this stack. There was a stack of previously very neatly organized responsibilities across layers in the particular stack, where people had been sitting, they had been grooming their position, that meant that they could take attacks from being exactly where they were, and suddenly things start happening. And this is, of course, has allowed here, as the example with Apple, allowed Apple to put in the middle, stretch themselves up to content and down to infrastructure, and they're about to start wiring up a big data center in North Carolina that's going to give online stream music from the cloud. So the point is, of course, that there are really these opportunities that some people have grabbed, like the Googles and the Amazons and the Apples of the world. And the last one is here to say, maybe in research we need to think about this instead of having our very clear pigeonholes of where we should be. Maybe we should be more agile in terms of this as well, but that's more an internal message. So, of course, lots of people then talk about digital convergence in these terms. So,
Hello, Bob, it's your father again. I have another question about my new computer. Can I tape a movie from a cable TV and then fax it from my VCR to my CD-ROM, then email it to my brother's cellular phone so he can make a copy on his neighbor's camcorder? And this is the essence of digitalization, which basically means that in principle, any output from any process can become an input to another process. And that means that you have it's very complicated arrangements that suddenly are possible that weren't possible before. And also, what you have is counterintuitively that convergence and divergence are not the opposites, are not opposites. Divergence and convergence are really just the same. So on my phone, of course, from a technical telecommunications point of view, this is a converged device that can collect all sorts of stuff in one little neat package. But from the point of view of me as a consumer, this is divergence. So now I want to make a call to somebody. I have to decide, do I want to use Wi-Fi on Skype, or do I want to use a landline call? Do I want to use maybe a VoIP call that I have a special number I can call? So there's a number of ways I can make a simple phone call on one device. So that for me, this is not convergence. This is divergence. So convergence is in the eye of the beholder. And of course, what we're seeing is, in terms of human behavior, this was Apple's first slogan when they launched the iTunes app, namely rip, mix, and burn. So this idea that when you increasingly digitize more and more content and more aspects, then you have this opportunity to redirect and recombine in unprecedented ways. And that leads then, and this is a larger discussion, and as you will note, I have very little time, so some of these will whoosh by you, and you will get access to them later if you want to make special notes or have a further need for the references. All the references that I mentioned on these slides are on the last slide, so you can have all of that for your own time, which you probably won't have. Most of us don't have time to do this, but at least I give you the offer. So the point is, what is happening then at a more fundamental level is that these digital infrastructures, they engender conflicts and what's called tussles. So a tussle is a situation where, think of it as a marriage. In most marriages are tussles that you cannot be separated, but you also sometimes have problems staying together. You know, a marriage without problems is not a proper marriage, in my view. So, of course, for most companies, this become a tussle, and what Jason just presented was the tussle that happens when Amazon and Apple and Google, they have this dance together. And sometimes it goes well, and other times it doesn't go well. And they need each other desperately, but yet they would really like to bump the other one off if they could, so they could get a bigger share of the market. So this is a common feature, whereas in the analog world, a lot of those tussles were happening over sort of tectonic plates that moved over long, 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 long time, where people had very carefully negotiated arrangements, whereas in the new world here, these things can happen overnight. So it's a very, very quick. And shaped by sort of the technicalities, the legal arrangement, and user behavior. So it's a very complex arrangement. And there are various reasons for this. And in this, we have particularly looked at issues of control points because, in this complicated arrangement where, in principle, anything is possible technically, then we need to look at how control is arranged, and then we discuss that in terms of a concept called control points, where we try and, at a granularity lower than institutions, we look at where is control enforced. And we're going to get more to that later in the presentation, but this is just a very simple model of at least four different concerns within telecommunications. So there's the service concern, so it'll be Vodafone or Orange or Three or whoever. It's the part of the organization that delivers services. Then there's also another part, or maybe another company that delivers infrastructure. Then there are the regulators and the user. And of course, there'll be all sorts of conflicts between these where, and even within these, from one service provider to the next. So when somebody comes along and takes a massive £1 billion infrastructure and decides they're just going to run VoIP over it, obviously that's not going to happen without a slight kerfuffle. And the same way, whenever you launch Skype, it always tells you don't ever use this for any important calls, which all of us who use Skype will know not to do. I'm sure now Microsoft has bought it. It'll come in many more variations, and it'll all work perfectly, and there won't be any blue screens of death anywhere when you use Microsoft Skype. But the point is, the regulator then, of course, have a key issue here that if you have a telecommunications service, you should be able to to call 911 and get an ambulance or a fireman or a police officer. And the point is, so there's this immediately all sorts of tussles, and these relate to this study we did of the iTunes store of very detailed control points at each of these four different levels. So, for example, here in the App Store, this simple notion that you're not allowed in the arrangements Apple and AT&T did, you are not allowed to open up voice sessions on AT&T's network if you are Apple, unless they give the permission. So there are these legally binding or technically arranged control points that are at a very detailed level. And that means the discussions of control is suddenly at a much more detailed level than previously. And when we talk about platforms, a platform is really just a different way of understanding control. Because the difference between a platform and a digital infrastructure is that there are one or a few actors in a platform who can exercise control. I've learned that we are standing on a burning platform, and we have more than one explosion. We have multiple points of scorching heat that are fueling a blazing fire around us. Apple disrupted the market by redefining the smartphone and attracting developers to a closed but very powerful ecosystem. In 2008, Apple's market share in the $300 plus price range was 25%. By 2010, it escalated to 61%. Apple demonstrated that if designed well, consumers would buy a high-end, a high-priced phone with a great experience, and developers would build applications. They changed the game, and today Apple owns the high-end range. So this was newly appointed CEO, Stephen Elop. And the point here is, of course, that what is really interesting is when suddenly you're researching something that not only has the interest of the industry, but also is on the front cover of T3 magazine for gadgets. So there's this month's special issue I just picked up, the June 2011. It's only about the battle. And this is like a 20-page special feature about the battle between Apple and Google on the mobile phone market. And this has happened. This started in 2007. So this is a very radical movement that has very profound, both theoretical and practical implications as to how we understand innovation, or digital innovation. And the point, so the first point is there are many different points here, and we've written extensively on this the past couple of years, but just a couple of points I want to highlight. One of them is this paradoxical relationship between control and generativity. So control is, of course, the ability of one actor to exercise control to guide behavior. Generativity is generally understood as the notion that you launch something and then others will take it beyond what you had imagined. So others will create stuff on whatever you had launched, that there's an openness. And Jason also talked about that, about interconnectivity, that you have APIs, application programming interfaces, for example. So the point here is that in the normal circumstances, you would the way Jonathan Citrain and Lawrence Lessig of the world, I think they normally consider this, is that that if you have control, then generativity disappears. But if you look at these platforms, this is actually not the case. So if you look at these platforms, if you take Apple for example, it is an incredibly controlling force on their own platform. And what happens is that almost the more they control this, the more generative the system becomes, for a variety of reasons. One of them is that there is a more interest for an individual developer to develop for a platform that is highly controlled, because that means the customer can rely on a reliable product. So they can rely on products being quality assured. But also, the fact that if you're a bedroom developer of an iPhone app, then or an Android app, then you have very little to worry about except your app. The distribution, the payment, everything, installation, all of that is outside your control, and you can use very high-end middleware handles to create very complex applications very, very quickly. And that is because of that's the tight control means generativity. So the way we look at it is, in that constant balancing or sorting out that paradox between control and generativity is very, very interesting, and one that really we need to understand more carefully. So, yeah, forget about those. So one of the things we've done, and this is Ben Eaton, hand up, Ben. That's Ben. And Sylvia, Hillel of Calderwood, that's Sylvia. So we're the three people who work at the LSE on this project. So what we've done is we've gone through 1,300 stories on the web about Apple, about Android and iOS, about the Apple iPhone infrastructure and Google's. And we've basically then codified those and dragged out a number of stories, a number of dramas where things are happening and there's some sort of conflict of what should happen. So there's the Adobe Flash case, there's should we watch porn on the iPhone, Google Voice on the iOS, there's all sorts of these ones, and they're all sort of dramas. For example, this one, where you have Adobe was desperate to get Flash embedded, so this is their own little platform they wanted to get on the iOS system, on the Apple system, so that you could watch Flash videos. Steve Jobs didn't want that for various reasons. Some of control, others of user experience, and all sorts of battery life. And so this is a whole drama unfolding. And the other one here is to whether Google Voice should run on Apple. And this was, of course, a big sore issue with AT&T because they had made a deal with Apple, and they didn't want Google suddenly to come running in and steal their thunder on the platform by just getting lots of minutes on Google Voice. So what we did was we try and then find out, so this is the populist version, this is not in the academic papers, but we try to find sort of the DNA of these platforms. So what are they made up of in terms of control? So there are many other things that makes them up than this, but this is, these eight different terms is basically what makes them up, and the way we thought about it is we thought like a good Shakespearean drama. There's a protagonist and an antagonist. So what is a good protagonist? A good protagonist is somebody who, like the hero in the story, wants to improve the world. They want something new to happen. They suggest improvements. The antagonist is the one that's the custodian of the platform or the custodian of something else. It's not necessarily the platform owner. But says, well, hold on a minute, is this now a good idea or not? And this battle is exactly what balances out the control and generativity issues. So the protagonist in charge of generativity and the antagonist is in charge of control. And what happens is the generative acts can either be, you can request or you can try and influence. So the interesting discussion is if you take the Norwegian company Opera, they instead of requesting Apple to allow its web browser onto iOS, it didn't do so because it knew it would get rejected straight away because Apple don't allow any competing apps. Unfortunately, don't compete unless it's from a really big player that's going to complain to mommy, namely the FCC. So instead, they try to influence. So they created this web campaign first that says that they had something unique that was not a browser. It was something about very fast online browsing and it was something that very, and caching sites and all sorts of things. And after a long period of influencing, they then requested and it was allowed. Of course, what happens, here you can also, if you get it rejected, for example, you can try and regroup by redefining, or you can also try to bypass. Hello, Annabelle. This is our next speaker, so we are settled. So the point is, in Google Voice's case, Apple didn't allow Google Voice to have an app on the iPhone that allows access to Google Voice, so instead they made HTML 5.0 service, so you can get to it from an ordinary web browser, and then by then they bypassed. So the antagonists, they have a number of defensive moves here. One of them is simply just to allow, and the other one is to block. But then you can also combine those, and you can have a redefining. You can say, well, I'll allow you to do this, but not in this area, not in this arena. Or you're allowed voice over IP, but not only on Wi-Fi. So this idea, there's a refinement. Or you can just ignore. So we've got examples of where it was just ignored. For example, the publishing business was largely ignoring Google and Apple's attempt to take their business, and they managed to succeed in being taken over. This one I don't have time for. This is just a very detailed analysis of these kind of stories where you end up with one where the protagonist wins, one where but the antagonist is passive, one where the protagonist wins, where the protagonist chooses to bypass, and one where the antagonist wins because they block, or one where they win because they manage to redefine the problem. And there's some more, so we can look at this in terms of sort of what happens down in these various kinds of. So this is like battles in a good drama, you know. You have these bouts of battles between the two. And what we've sort of done, I'm sorry if it's not too readable, but what we did was we created a small machine. So this is a small machine that can generate any kind of platform discussion. So it basically starts by the protagonist has to start the process by requesting something or by trying to influence or by trying to bypass the antagonist altogether. And then the antagonist can either allow, block, or ignore, or the second time around can redefine or regroup, and that can go on until one of them gets tired of this and they stop. And this is a very, very simple formalization to just explain, in terms of control, this is going on a daily basis in this platform world. I think I'm a little bit over time, so I'm going to go very quickly on the last two slides. So basically, and we have papers we've written on this if you want more detail. So basically, we basically worked out using some existing theory for management science. There's a paper by Poole and van der Veen, for those who are keen to get the reference, on if you have a dilemma or a paradox, there are only four ways you can solve it. So the first way is, for the sake of simplicity, let's use the marriage metaphor for the paradox. It makes it easier instead of the platform. So if you have the tension and you feel the tension, there's a paradox in your everyday life, you can either choose to accept it and then ignore it. You don't do anything. There are lots of examples of that in this platform where basic stakeholders, they chose not to do anything. And of course, this is Stephen Elop's burning platform. He said, Nokia, we're the king of the hill, and we ignored it for a long period of time, or we didn't manage to deliver on it. The second one is spatial separation, right? So you just make sure you live two different places. Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir, they lived around the corner from each other for 27 years. That's how they kept their marriage alive, right? Or they technically weren't married. But the point is that you have spatial separation. The other one is temporal separation, which is you just have shift work, one work days, another work nights. But the point is, we have identified that as control strategies for platform innovation as well. And the last one is synthesis, which is that you basically find a way around it, so suddenly it is possible to do in a way that everybody is happy. And that, of course, is, in a sense, you can say that the Apple and Google's platforms are a way of synthesizing the problem we had before, namely, people were desperate to use mobile phones, but none of them would download anything or go on the internet. So how do we make people spend more money? Do we try to make them use WAP applications. Who cared? Walled gardens and WAP, we've all been there, 1997, those were the days where nothing happened. Now suddenly Apple and Google came up with a way of combining this paradox, you want an internet access on a small handset. How does that work? Well, this was the example. And just to finish this one, I'm going to drop, it's too complicated. So just to give you a very small, it's a follow-up on Jason's slides on platforms. So one of the problems we have is that we are venturing into a completely new arrangement. And one of the things we've been studying for quite a long while is to try and understand how digital infrastructures are different from physical ones. And the point is they're digital infrastructures are exactly like physical infrastructures, except they're very, very different. So a lot of the things you can know about physical infrastructures, you can also say about digital ones, like installed base is important. The more reach you have in a network, the more important. And interestingly, digital infrastructures rely heavily on physical ones, like the backbone and the last mile into the last meters into the house and all of those things. But the problem is the digital infrastructures are also different in one very, very important aspect, namely that they rely on digitalization. And that means, imagine if you rented from Network Rail the right to drive trains from London Bridge to Brighton. And you could then invent a new service on top of that that would make Network Rail useless and irrelevant. So the point is, digital infrastructures are relative. That means that they are not absolutely defined in terms of clear layers. They are relative, and that means they are sort of floating in the clouds, and they are subjected to all sorts of turning up and down. There is no up and down, and there is no sense of easy ways of gaining control. And that's what this complicated slide really says. That's it. Thank you for your time.